meeting that we promised you, and we were going to have a speaker, Stephen Zarlinga, and Randy Cook will head it off this morning. I will take a moment while people are gathering in here, and I know some will be drifting in because they can't get in. Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and within a couple of months, Congress passed legislation that returned the greatest industry in America, namely agriculture, back to the 1929 level. We operated World War II and through the end of that decade, in fact, with structural balance for the American economy and with parity for agriculture. That parity was struck down in 1948 with the passage of the Aiken Bill. Truman managed to get extensions to the parity year by year until the Eisenhower administration took over. And then Ezra Taft Benson said, we're going to quit mollycoddling the farmers. We're going to go to a 60 to 90% of parity program. Now, what has all this to do with money? We submit that the raw production from planet Earth, the trapping of energy from the sun via the agency of chlorophyll and photosynthesis into crops and so on, is the lion's share, probably over 70% of the new wealth that comes into the system each year. Since 1950, we've been on a downhill slide to now we have probably agriculture getting no more than about 30% of parity. Think of it this way. In 1948, the postage stamp was 4 cents. What's the postage stamp today? If you raised corn and wheat and basic storable commodities from 82% of the harvested acres, according to the same general projection, that would give you parity today. Instead, we've got corn, we've got basic storable commodities. Who's turning off all the lights? Don't turn off all the lights. It's too bad enough the way it is. We're now getting prices, destabilizing prices, that are no better than they were back in the 30s. Somebody's still fooling around with the lights. This is basically what we'd like to talk about and try to make the bridge with what happens in the monetary system. People do not understand money, how it's created, and this is what Mr. Zarlinga is going to try to cover this morning. But before we do that, we have to release this year the 2004 economic report of the producers. Randy Cook will explain that economic report, and I hope everyone in here has a copy of it or will have one before you leave. The economic report of the producer takes the statistical input that's used to construct the economic report of the president. The only difference is we come up with different conclusions than the Council of Economic Advisers is coming up with. And that has to be explained. I think we can explain it, and I don't believe they can. So, with those few introductory remarks, I would say this. In the economic report, I have an article this year which gives sort of a history of the United States and what's happened every time that you had price structures in the United States destroyed through import invasion. Administration by administration, from Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, on down through the line, John Quincy Adams, etc. And every time that we went that route, we ended up in a tailspin. And every time we maintained our stability and our structural balance for the American economy, we had general prosperity for the country. With that, let's bring Randy Cook up here. Randy, I want you to take over and talk about the economic report, and then when you're through, why you can introduce our speaker this morning. Randy?
Thank you. This is all, I'm sure, to most of us, as it was to me about 7 years ago, a bunch of words. I could hear it. It didn't really make much sense. They sound good. They have an impact on our ears, and we hope they have an impact on our brain, but it seems as though unless we repeat it often enough, we don't really get a chance to work with it as an idea and make it seem real to us in the things we do from day to day, particularly as farmers, as producers, using what Charles indicated is the photosynthetic investment of sunshine into plant material here on our planet that goes through all of us, our animals, our livestock, ourselves, and gives us the power to develop brain cells with which we can deal with the sorts of ideas that Norm has been dealing with for 34 years now, and prior to that, all the way back to 1936. The Raw Materials National Council was established in 1936 by a group of fellas in Iowa, Owen L. Brownlee, Carl H. Wilkin, J. Carson Adkerson, names you can find in Chuck's Unforgiven book. It'll put them in some perspective for you, their contributions, their thinking. Economics is very difficult and confusing to us because it has been made that way. In speaking with Mr. Zarlinga last night, I heard him talk about an editorial page editor for a prominent financial analysis magazine who was moving to another job or retiring. He mentioned in his last editorial that he had the door open, he had his car downstairs out the curb at idle, ready to go, and so here was his last editorial, and what he said was, macroeconomics is bunk. And it is. The way stuff is bandied about, the free trade policies of our last 10 administrations, the debt of the United States, the debt of the private persons in the United States, not just the government, but our everyday borrowings from credit cards and check money, all of that as policy stated by government is bunk. Norm and the Raw Materials National Council is the only organization I am familiar with that has a sound approach to macroeconomics, a sustainable approach to macroeconomics, and we can document from the history of the United States what works, what doesn't, why it works, why it doesn't, and we can offer proposals to make it work today. In 1965, Carl Wilkin, one of the original founders of this method of analysis, published a little book here called Preliminary Balance Sheet for the 12 Central Midwestern States. He took states of Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Michigan, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, Ohio, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. He analyzed their state personal income from 1946 through 1963, which were the latest numbers he had. He showed how the losses, the income that should have been paid into circulation through the price structure. Yes, sir. Times price equals income. Every farmer knows that. All of our macroeconomic policies at the national level ignore price. Price must be set in a free market by competitive producers and competitive buyers, and this is what's all bunk. Carl Wilkin looked at the history of the United States' economy, took the numbers as published by the government, and said, okay, we had a balanced base period where we didn't have any inflation. We had liquidity in our banks. We had wide distribution of incomes. We had prosperity. We didn't have any rupture of our pricing structure through import invasion. And we had that three times in the last century in this country. We had it from 1910 through 14. We had it from 1925 through 1929. And we had it from 1941, well, 42 actually is when it took hold, 1942 through 1950. Now, the first two times happened. The last time, 1942 through 1950, it was done by conscious adoption of policy at the federal level. And the policy that was adopted was written by Carl Wilkin. It was taught to Congress from 1938 on. It was adopted by them before Pearl Harbor was bombed. After Pearl Harbor was bombed and the Second World War started, those provisions for parity agricultural policy were broadened, brought from 85% of parity to 90% of parity, and the Second World War was fought and won, which we didn't know we could do. And for 2 years following World War II, those policies were mandated to continue. As Chuck said earlier, in 1948, the 60 to 90% sliding parity thing was adopted by the Congress in an attempt to put this out of its misery, put us into our misery. And what has happened since then, that's what Carl Wilkin documented in this book in 1965. If anybody's been following our economic report of the producers, we produced the first one 2 years ago. We produced, in this one, we started using calculations to show the losses to individual counties around the nation. We selected a few counties and documented the loss in price and how it affects the income of counties, county government, state government. Last year's report, 2003, I took the state of Iowa and continued the same analysis, figured out how many dollars the state of Iowa lost. Iowa's lost income in 1 year on four crops was $12 billion. Now, there's a state that's having a budget problem. $12 billion might fix it. This year, I have taken Carl Wilkin's preliminary balance sheet and extended it to all 50 states plus the District of Columbia up until and through 2002. Documenting the loss of income that has been suffered by this nation in 52 years. And the number is one that you cannot really grasp. The number is $26 trillion. It's over $26 trillion. What is that? If you have a millionaire and you turn that one millionaire into 26 million millionaires, that's the number. That's how many dollars have not been spent into circulation. That would buy all of the federal debt of the United States. It would buy all of the state debt of the United States. It would buy all of the debt of the local governments of the United States. It would buy all of the debt of you and me in the United States today. And it would leave about $3 trillion left over. There's a tax cut for you. Nobody's talking about that at the federal level because they keep following this bunk. They want us to understand that bunk. Well, we don't. Economics can be understood. It can be understood pretty regularly, pretty simply. Let's go to the... Well, this is who we are, and you can pick up a sheet like this over here at our booth in the exhibitors area. Tells who we are and what we're about. We have a good piece written by Chuck in our current economic report on tariffs, in particular this item number two here, parity tariffs. It's a very good piece, and anybody who doesn't understand what tariffs are not trade measures. Tariffs are monetary measures. They adjust the buying power of our dollar in terms of our production. That's what they should do. Nobody is interested in tariffs at the international, national level because that restricts the power of international finance to steal your money. The next one. This is an economy, and that's what there is to it. This is the exchange equation. The products move around the outside clockwise. produce and move clockwise around the outside. That is the exchange equation right there. And it starts when the farmer buys the input required to produce a crop. We've got to first have air. We are air-breathing human beings. That's our basic characteristic. We breathe air. We're gas bags. Then we've got to have water. Then we've got to have food. Then we've got to have shelter and clothing. And from there on, we can divide our labor and produce more than one can consume, assemble into social units, specialize, divide our labor, and keep on multiplying our efforts as a group until we achieve what we have had in this country as a high standard of living. The money follows the other way around. Money is a medium of exchange only, that's all. It's not wealth. The wealth is what you eat and wear and drive. All of this was recognized in law in the 33 AAA Act. This is Section 602. The first Section 601, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, was the effort of Franklin Roosevelt to try and deal with the Depression of the 1930s. At 601, he said, the Congress said that there's an emergency out here because the low prices of farm commodities are threatening the credits, the agricultural assets that underpin the national credit structure. So they recognized the value of agriculture in the nation's economy. And so because they took they declared an emergency and said, we are taking the production rights, the marketing rights of every farmer who produces something, we are taking those marketing rights in the national public interest. Section 601 still sits in our law today. There is still an emergency over agriculture. Section 602 brings in the compensation scheme. Our Fifth Amendment says that you can't take private property for public use without just compensation. So at 601, the government in 1933 took the marketing rights. At Section 602, they said, here's your compensation. It is declared to be the policy of the Congress that the Secretary of Agriculture establish, maintain orderly marketing conditions for agricultural commodities in interstate commerce as well establish as the prices to farmers parity prices. That's still current law. But they don't do it. What would happen if we did do it? Oh, this is the basis upon which regulation of the money and commerce is a province of Congress. It's not a province of the Federal Reserve Banks. It's not a province of the WTO. It's a province of the Congress of the United States. And as I said, what happens when agriculture is paid parity prices is this. This is 1946 to 50. These are the averages in our national economy. This is the whole national economic pie.
Balanced economic period, what we have is this number plus this number. As you can see, it's about 66 1/3 of that here. And the sum of those numbers is what's left over. It's about 33 1/3%. If we have 2/3 cost and 1/3 income or revenue, This is always the characteristic from 1910 to 14, from 1925 to 29, from 1942 to 1950. In this case, in order to avoid the association with war, we picked 1946 to 50. That's what a balanced economy looks like. That's what a balanced economy does. This is what we're at today. Well, we're on almost 80% cost and about 20% income. Why? If you can see that little pie-shaped wedge, you're doing better than me.
Farm income is production times price. We make the production. We don't earn the income because the price isn't paid through the marketplace, as the Secretary of Responsibility, the Secretary of Agriculture's responsibility, says he's supposed to pay the parity prices for taking our agricultural marketing rights. Now, if you want to get the government out of agriculture, that's fine. My response is, if the government doesn't want to pay parity prices, then end the emergency that they've declared and stop taking our marketing rights. But if you've taken the marketing rights and refused to give them back, your responsibility is to pay parity prices. And of course, they do neither. They continue the emergency and they don't pay parity prices. And so this is what we get as a result. This is the result of our study in this year's Green Economic Report of the Producers. 51 states. Well, 50 states in the District of Columbia, across 52 years, and this is our magic number up here, from the underpayment of agriculture and the multiplication, all the multiplier is, I'm sure a lot of folks have heard of it, the multiplier in most of the original norm literature, early norm literature, was identified to be about 1 to 7. You take gross farm income, cash farm receipts to farm marketings, and multiply it by 7, and you come up with national income. These days, that multiplier is about, as far as the dollars go, it's about 24. And that's not so good or so bad by itself. The problem is that the labor turn, the ratio of raw materials workers to the rest of the civilian labor population is about 36. And 24 is only 3/4 of 36, which means that the dollars we have are not sufficient to pay the people we got working. And this is what happens. We don't earn enough through the price mechanism, price times production, to pay ourselves properly, so we have to borrow money, go into debt, and we wind up short of solvent earned income, debt-free income, to pay our bills. And over 52 years, this is the result. All the states in our report are documented. Each one's got a little graph in here. And at the end of it, I've got a listing in alphabetical order of where each state ranks and what their actual deficit or surplus was. Some states have had surpluses over 52 years. But all of us together have suffered this loss up here, $26 million. This is one of my favorite charts, and I just wanted to throw it up here and show you some of the things that happen when money varies in value. And I hope this will lead into Mr. Zarlinga's remarks here, because this is the key element in what's going on here. As Mike Calicrate once told us, there is a technical economic term for what's going on, and it's called cheating. The blue line here is the consumer price index from 1800. This is 2001 actually. Now that's based on this period right in here. This is 100. 1947 to 49 is 100. Right here is our 100 line. So if this is 100 cents to the dollar,
than back here in 1920. Our dollar was about 80 cents. Back here in 1864, it was about 65 cents. Back here in 1814, all was about 70 cents. Fairly steady across this period until we get right in here into 1971
when Nixon unhooked the dollar from anything at all, and off we went. We have a question? Oh, okay. Well, the red line on here is the market value or the market price of a bushel of wheat.
In 1867, the price of wheat in the marketplace was $2 a penny. But it bought about $3.50 worth of goods. In 2000, the market price was $2.57, higher than it was in 1867. And yet it bought less than 50 cents worth of goods.
That's a fluctuating currency value, which hurts us all and produces what we saw in the previous graph here. Any questions? I'm going to roll this along and let Mr. Zarlinga get up here and explain further what's wrong with our money system. Okay. Stephen Zarlinga is a good friend at the moment, anyway. I hope I haven't ruined his friendship here. He's got a great book. You can pick it up at our Norm booth down here. And what he said is more than interesting. It's vital information in understanding what money is, how it works, how it doesn't work, and what to do to fix it. Stephen Zarlinga.
Thank you, Randy. Can you hear me? The mic on? Good. It's an honor to address the Acres USA meeting, and I thank Fred and Charles Walters and Randy Cook and Greg Neuendorf for this opportunity to focus on the money system itself, which is society's greatest dispenser of justice or injustice. Like it or not, the great unspoken social truth of our time is that we're neck deep in an unacknowledged class war, an epic human struggle for the monetary control of societies. This operates through a misnamed free market economics where special monetary privileges are given to the few at the expense of the many. Because great power is exercised through money, power-hungry elements from ancient times to the present have pursued the political ambition to dominate through the money power. The main weapon has been the manipulation of language and thought, where definitions serve as heavy artillery. Those benefiting from the corruption see that professionals are financed to promote their viewpoint through economic theories. Farmers have been a special target, it seems, in this struggle, because you have something that the opponents really want. Two things, actually: production from the farms and your land. But this is not new. It's been going on for thousands of years. Monetary reform has often been the key, not just to progress, but to survival in agriculture. Almost back to the invention of the plow, which from about 4500 BC first made urban civilization possible in the first place. But the money systems and exchanges developed in cities were not always beneficial to farmers. And from ancient times to the present, farmers have been repeatedly caught in what you could call usury traps. In these epic social crises, destiny brought forward mankind's greatest statesman to carry out monetary reform. Uh-oh. Am I on? Okay. When Solon of Athens came to power in about 600 BC, the class of free small farmers was vanishing in Greece, in Athens, being sold into slavery to pay debts with their land grabbed by a rich oligarchy.
Recently, in this century, Professor Calhoun identified the unseen monetary cause of this problem. Quote, before the introduction of coin, time when money was cheap and commodities were expensive. When a year of plenty came and he tried to repay the loan in money, his crops were cheap and money was expensive. So the very act of farming caused seasonal changes in the relation between money, crops, supplies, and the exchange process worked against the farmer. Eventually, bad weather or a poor harvest could get him and his entire family sold into slavery. Solon took sweeping actions. He gave back the lands that had been confiscated for debts. He bought back farmers who had been sold into slavery. He forbade pledging the debtor's person and his family as collateral for loans. And he required license fees for the import of foodstuffs into Athens. In other words, these were essentially protectionist measures. And his specific monetary actions could apply today. First, he lowered the value of money, so it was easier to get money and loans were easier to repay. Second, he introduced a lot more coinage into circulation for the same reason. Money was easier to get, loans could be easily repaid. And third, and what concerns us here regarding parity, is that he monetized several crops at specified prices so that loans could be repaid without money through a process that was within the farmer's control. This is the key. Now, what does it mean to monetize crops? It's to legally declare a specific price value for them and to revise it from time to time as conditions change. Some of these ancient monetizations were limited to using the crops for debt repayment. And monetization of farm products for loan repayment has a long and apparently successful history. Before Solon, there was Hammurabi, whose price lists of about 1800 BC are now reinterpreted. They're not what economists thought. They were not controls, price controls against inflation, which did not work. They were monetized floor prices for farm commodities when used to repay loans or fines, and they did work. And they worked in Rome, where Rome's Lex Aeterna Tarpeia law of 454 BC was written after the return of ambassadors from Athens who had gone there to study Solon's legislation. It established minimum prices for farm animals when used to repay loans or fines. It meant that the critters did not have to be sold in a market, thereby depressing their prices. Where, in fact, just the knowledge of an impending fine would otherwise depress prices because then they knew that the animals would be coming onto the market. The law allowed the animals to be transferred at full specified value. These were floor prices because if market prices were higher, then presumably the farmers could have sold these animals in the market and got the cash. These ancient cases and more recent examples from our own colonial history are described in my book, The Lost Science of Money book, which we have at the Norm counter. And in Charles Walter's great book, Unforgiven. And if you haven't read this yet, you should, as farmers, you absolutely need to read this book. I'm here to affirm that from a monetary point of view, the key principles behind this program, as described by Charles, are monetarily sound and should become a part of our money reform process. And I'm here to confirm to you that as farmers, you have much more than just a dog in this fight. You may have your farm in this monetary fight, ultimately. I'm also going to ask you to join with us in helping to achieve the needed monetary reforms, because the monetary system is at the root of problems not just in farming, but across our entire economy. An example of the class warfare, a recent example that'll be fresh in your memory. About a month ago, Alan Greenspan told us that we should stop paying for Social Security. because we can't afford it. You remember that? Yeah. Well, you could view this as a kind of a threat, a form of mental terrorism that raises stress levels, makes people sick, even kills a few. You don't hear Alan Greenspan advising the U.S. to break its promise to pay interest and principal on our debt to our bondholders. That would have caused heart attacks among the bond traders. You won't hear him explain why paying bondholders is more sacred than the promises made to working people. And that shows you how this, it's not quite class warfare in the sense of English-type class. We don't have that yet. We're getting that slowly as money has concentrated and as those other class distinctions will develop. The question arises, does Alan Greenspan really know what he's doing? You've all heard how he raised interest rates 11 times in 3 years to fight a non-existent inflation. Recently, he admitted the Fed did not know how to define money and therefore couldn't really measure how much was in circulation. Well, in my view, he should have been released from his duties there several years back, about 8 years ago. You may remember he made a joke. He said, if you thought you understood what I said in my recent congressional testimony, you were most certainly mistaken. Now, if he wanted to be a stand-up comedian, he should have left the Fed in more serious hands. The Fed is making life and death decisions. It's determining interest rates. It's determining the amount of money out there, which I think we all agree is not enough. And Randy's excellent calculation of $26 trillion is amazing. I have heard from a good economist, and there are some, and we shouldn't forget that, that there's one Nobel Prize winner, in fact, a guy by the name of William Vickrey, who's tended to have populist orientation. He estimated that $8 trillion was missing, that there should be another $8 trillion. Well, it's a start. Now, our money problems, though, go beyond the shortcomings of any individual Fed chairman or economists. They're rooted in the false structure of the money system and what the American Monetary Institute has determined. The results of our research are that the cause of this results from the misdefinition of money. Philosophers have created a science of money, a valid one, all the way back to Aristotle. We can trace it. Economists have created a mythology of money, especially crystallized from the time of Adam Smith. This mythology has obscured the nature of money. Aristotle gave the culmination of Greek thought in about 300 BC, Greek thought and experiment on money, and he outlined the science that's still valid today. Here's what he said. I'll give his whole quote. All goods must therefore be measured by some one thing. Now, this unit is in truth demand, which holds everything together. But money has become, by convention, a representative of demand. This is why it has the name nomisma, N-O-M-I-S-M-A. This is important for a reason I'll explain. Because it exists not by nature, but by law, which in Greek was nomos, N-O-M-O-S. And it's in our power to change it and make it useless. What's he done? He's identified money as an abstract legal power, a social invention. Its essence, as Randy pointed out, is not tangible wealth, but the power to obtain wealth, the power to exchange it for wealth. This is a crucial distinction that economists have not caught up with yet. Aristotle outlines the science. Plato agreed completely. They didn't always agree. And he advocated this is called fiat money. It's created by the fiat of the law. And when we hear complaints from some monetary people who think of themselves as monetary reformers, we hear complaints against fiat money. What they're really complaining about is money, because all money by nature is fiat, or should be, the creature of the law. And the importance of that we will see at our Constitutional Convention. No. Plato said they'll need a marketplace and a money token for purposes of exchange. Now, we find these key principles employed in Greek and Roman systems. Aristotle explained money is not a commodity. In clear demonstration of that principle, the Spartans, about 800 BC, purposely destroyed the commodity value of their money by dipping it in vinegar while it was hot to destroy the value of the iron that they used for money, because the commodity value interfered with the actual functioning as money. Aristotle explained that you can create money just by law. The Romans demonstrated that by creating the value of their copper money just by legal fiat again. And that you can make it useless during the Carthaginian Wars, the Punic Wars. The Romans demonetized the money that was in towns that were thinking of joining up with Hannibal. And the towns could do nothing about it because the copper money that they had was legally valued many, many times its weight of copper or bronze. Today, well, what we have here is that right from Aristotle's time, we see evidence of a great battle between private money and government money. This is the key. This is the key divide historically. This is our own history, if it's properly written, is between a fight between privately controlled money and government-controlled money. And we see it right from Aristotle's time in that his word for money, nomisma, it's not found in ancient Greek texts. You find it in Herodotus in the 400s BC. You see it again in Aristotle over 100 years later. Now, what we think is that the term was suppressed in an ongoing struggle between an oligarchy, a rich old boy network that liked to trade based on credit and their old relations, against the nomisma, which had been introduced and controlled by the newer city-state organization, the Greek polis. It probably goes back before that, but we see that. This continued in Rome, a battle between the plutocracy and Rome. It continued in England. In England, it became a battle between the goldsmiths and the monarchy over this control. We'll go into more detail with the norm meaning, if anyone likes. It continues today in the United States, and our own history is one of the richest in terms of monetary experimentation. Both the Brits and the Dutch did not allow money to be exported into the colonies here. They didn't want the colonists trading with each other. They wanted them supplying commodities home, the same way as globalization tends to work today. So our forebears here tried every monetary experiment, and for a long time we were the most intelligent people in terms of monetary concepts because we tried them. We found out what worked, what didn't work. We went through every type of example, and again, we don't have time to do that here, but we'll do that in the norm meeting. And the key element in this battle, which we then trace from Adam Smith, is the following. Today, it's still the bankers versus society. And this started here thanks largely to mistakes or to oversights made at our Constitutional Convention. In 1776, Adam Smith helped erect a mythology of money, obscuring the science of money. History and thought shows that money's essence is legal power, as we mentioned. Economists are still arguing whether it should be a commodity like gold. Ron Paul just introduced legislation to go onto a gold standard. Other economists are pretending that money has to be a credit issued by a bank and then legally monetized. Economics has never properly defined money, and this is thanks to the father of economics himself, Adam Smith, who promoted this confusion by removing the legal concept of money in his definition. Definitions are crucial. They are, as I mentioned, the heavy artillery in this fight. Here's what he defined money as. By the money price of goods, it's to be observed, I understand always the quantity of pure gold or silver for which they are sold without any regard to denomination of the coin. He took the concept of money back to it where it was in England before the Romans arrived. That's what his definition is. That insinuated a mythology of money in economics. Economics has not recovered from that error, and it will not until that error is corrected. Now, our proposed reforms, I'm going to give these to you just very, very briefly. We'll go into details later. We began the introduction of these proposals in Washington on Monday and Tuesday with meetings with congressional aides. It's the beginning of a long-term process. First, to nationalize the Federal Reserve System and reconstitute it within the U.S. Treasury, where it is encouraged to grow into a fourth branch of government. When you think about it, the monetary power affects us on a daily basis far more than either the executive, the legislative, or the judicial branch. Day to day, and in your work, it's the monetary power. There is going to be a fourth branch of government. Three was never enough, not in England, not here. The fourth branch will exist. It's better to recognize it and to control it and to have it within our society and societal control. All right. Second point of the reform, remove the privilege which banks have to create money. This is crucial. Bank of England was nationalized in 1946. It helped a lot, but it was not enough because they did not remove the power of the private banks to continue creating money. We can do that here, and further through a very elegant process, we can convert all the existing money that the banks have created to date into U.S. government money. And we'll describe exactly how that's done in the norm meeting. Third, and this is where the price parity concept becomes very important. Third, we institute programs for automatic constitutionally determined government money creation. We start with the $2 trillion that the Society of American Civil Engineers tell us is necessary to bring our infrastructure up to acceptable levels. And a part of that process, right from the beginning, or as soon as it can be, is to introduce a price parity system for agriculture, because this has features which are crucial in the introduction of money. First, that it gets spread geographically over a wide area, over the entire country, as that would do. Second, it's dispersed in relatively small amounts so that it does not continue to add to a concentration of money and wealth process. And third, it makes good sense from a social policy point of view. It's not just a question of profits. It's not just a question of profit and loss that will define what's needed for humanity to thrive and to move into the future, into the third millennium, which we're here now. We have to start using thoughtful concepts. The objection that the economists and others will bring up against this is, isn't that socialism? You know, we're so scared. I've never seen a people more frightened of words than we are. And it's because we've been abused through our media for so many decades. It's not socialism or any ism. I'm not here to promote an ism. It's a question of being reasonable and addressing particular problems in the way that they should be addressed. Some have to be addressed individually. Others must be addressed as a group. And if you don't do it that way, there's always going to be some subgroup within that group that's powerful enough to control. It'll be the Enrons. It'll be, you're familiar with what kind of groups can do that. Now, we have 1 minute. Okay, the norm meeting is going to continue with the parity system. I'll show how government money has a far superior record during the periods when our government did control the money system in this country. That's happened from time to time. I'll show you how private central banking began in this country, and it's a story. It's essentially criminal, and you'll understand that. It was based on fraud, was based on overwhelming a group that did not have the full knowledge of what was going on. And you may know that one of the conditions of a contract is that people understand it. A contract's invalid when either party is not aware of what it means. And that's been our condition with money right back to the Constitutional Convention. We'll also talk about how the attack how the attack on government, which we see prevalent today, government is attacked for virtually everything. There's such a smear campaign that's going on against our government. You can't turn on the radio without hearing a part of it for 15 hours a day. Basically, in our upstate Albany area, we get 15 hours a day. We get Rush Limbaugh, we get Sean Hannity, we get Michael Savage, we get all these guys. At base, they're attacking government. Where did that start? We found the beginning of that in Adam Smith. And the reason for it, in his attack on England, actually, the reason for it was to keep the monetary power within private hands, to keep the monetary power in the hands of a private Bank of England. That's where this started. And that clues us in to the importance of the monetary power. We'll discuss other reform proposals, such as the gold standard, free banking, local currencies, why they may have good points or bad points, usually not good, and how they would affect farmers. So I think my time's up. Thank you very much for your attention.